Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today is Nicholas Bazbanes. He's a journalist, author, and lecturer who is widely known as an authority on the history of books and book culture. His books include the bestseller A Gentle Madness, still the most comprehensive book on the subject of book collecting, Patience and Fortitude about the Past and Future of Libraries, World of Letters, A History of the Yale University Press, and Splendor of Letters, The Permanence of the Book in an Impermanent World. He's talking to us today by telephone about his ninth and most recent book, On Paper, The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History, published by Knopf in 2013 and awarded by the American Library Association a Best Book of the Year award for nonfiction. Welcome, Nick.
Well, thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you. I'm thrilled to have you on the show, really, and sorry we don't have about, 9 hours to discuss your books one by one. They all go right to the heart of what the program is about, the transmission of knowledge and book culture. And you know something about interviewing authors yourself, I gather.
That's kind of how I got into this business in the first place. This is 2014, and I say that because this year marks the 50th anniversary for me of getting my first paycheck as a journalist. You say, oh my goodness, a cub reporter back in 1964 while I was still going to college. But, you know, I've been at this journalism business for an awful long time. But for 13 years, beginning in 1978, I was a literary editor for the Worcester Telegram in Massachusetts and had that job for 13 years. And then for 6 or 7 years after that, I wrote a syndicated column of a weekly literary feature where, as you do here, I interviewed an author every week. You know, I did it for 20 years, usually in Boston. And these were the major authors of the day who were coming around through Boston or wherever, and we'd sit and have a chat just like you and I are having now, and I would write these features about them, and it was carried in 30 newspapers, more or less, and it was all about the book world. And of course, I'm a lifelong bibliomaniac. It's kind of funny, as a side note, my wife and I visited Hawaii a few years back. Somebody who was giving a lecture there at the University of Hawaii, and in the student newspaper, they had noticed my arrival there under the headline "Bibliomaniac in Paradise," which I figured that's going to be my epitaph, you know. Yeah. But that's your question. I've been interviewing authors, writing about them, and it just, you know, was a progression of things. And when I decided I really wanted to go into the world of being an author myself, the first book I worked on was A Gentle Madness.
About bibliomania, right?
Bibliomania, so, right? The passion for books, but the passion also to preserve them, to save them, to collect them. Not just to amass and acquire and hoard them, you know. One of the premises of that book was how so much of our culture and our literary heritage is really preserved by these impassioned people, whether mindfully or not, you know. gathering is the first impulse, but then in the process, how so many of them managed to preserve things that might otherwise be lost. So that was the premise for that first book, and I had a great time with it. And then came Patience and Fortitude, which is named for the lions that stand guard in front of the New York Public Library in New York. So that was kind of my commentary on libraries in general, book culture in general. And it just went on, as you say, through 8 books, and then the current one just sort of emerged out of that. You know, it's a book about paper. But the driving impulse there was, okay, I've written about bibliomania, or I've written about bibliophilia, I've written about biblioclasm, you know, the deliberate destruction of books. I've written a book about reading. I've done all of these things. But how about a book now on the writing surfaces, the recording surfaces, the material of transmission? And, you know, and for us here in the West, for many hundreds of years, and earlier in China, in the Middle East, that material has been paper. So that was really what got me into doing that, and that was an 8-year project, and as so happens with me, these projects take on a life of their own, and I just found paper in and of itself to be this totally compelling and fascinating subject, while books and writing and the preservation of history and culture and the documentation of bureaucracy and all of these other things it just went on and on and just became this very fascinating subject.
It's interesting. Sooner or later, all scholars seem to gravitate toward the medium itself and the study of the medium itself. I think there's a sort of logic to it. I'm not sure what it is, but generally speaking, for historians now, you know, of course, material culture is a big part of history. And
huge, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's important for historians now to know about paper and its production and its sale and distribution. And it provides a lot of historical evidence for other kinds of things. So.
Well, that's a very perceptive question, because I am also a student, and I like to think a scholar of research libraries and the things that they're interested in. And it's no longer just books and papers, but it is also that you find at many of the great institutions the material objects that surround the paperwork, you know. And I'm just kind of looking at, for some reason, unrelated, but looking at Longfellow and how Harvard, for instance, has this remarkable collection of his manuscripts, his letters, his journals. But if you really want to see how he was perceived in his day and internationally, it also makes sense to go over to the Longfellow house where he lived in Cambridge, where you have these thousands upon thousands of artifacts and things which give you a sense of how he was perceived in his time. And it is the materiality of things, you know, that kind of gives you that extra dimension.
Yeah, context is really important for readers. And we had a discussion a while back with Beth Louie, who writes on writing, scholarly writing. She tries to make scholarly writing more legible, essentially. And she talked then about the difficulty of most scholarly writing, and the question often does come up on our program whether academic writing shouldn't be more engaging to the general reader. And, you know, your book does this quite successfully, all your books do, in part, in this case, because I think it's a kind of travelogue as well as a history. You know, scholars say of the French Revolution, for instance, don't usually talk about the circumstances of their trips to Paris, you know, and their visits to the French National Archives. Although there's one exception there, Carolyn Steedman, in her book on dust, does just this, and I think that has a lot to do with the fact that it's such a wonderful book. But you do this, you know, and I wonder if you just do it instinctively.
I do it mindfully. For me, the best writing is the kind of writing that looks effortless. But accessibility to me is everything, and I have to say I couldn't agree with you more. Unfortunately, it really is unfortunate, because so much of academic writing, and I wrote a history, you know, of the Yale University Press centennial at their invitation, the World of Letters book, and I really did want to do a book on academic and scholarly writing and publishing, because it is essential. And you find, however, unfortunately, so much of this material, and I'm not speaking about just Yale, because I think Yale is the great success story and actually operate in the black. But narrative is lost. I mean, you have these extraordinarily fascinating and interesting concepts and ideas, which at the outset, when you see the premise, you say, wow, I can't wait to get into that book. And then you enter it, and it just seems like it's written for a few other colleagues.
Yeah, it is.
Peers. Yeah. And what had such great promise is lost. And what I try to do, I try to take a scholarly approach in what I do. I'm so proud of the notes and the apparatus that I have in that book. I think the endnotes by themselves are longer than any single chapter in the book, you know.
Yeah.
And there are so many other stories contained in those endnotes that are narratives in and of themselves. So, but my point is, I really take great pains to cite and to give references to everything that I do. Everything I believe is fully documented. So if anybody wants to learn more, that apparatus is there for you. But storytelling is the thing to me. It's narrative. It don't mean a thing if it ain't got that swing. And I'm really trying to always tell a story.
The experiential side of it does add something to your comprehension of the concept. You're talking about the origins of papermaking in China, the fact that you go to China.
Well, I went there.
You went there. Yeah, exactly.
This is where paper was invented 2,000 years ago. And guess what? There are still places in China where they make it in much the same way as they did when it was invented there 2,000 years ago. So you know what? I'm a journalist, and I'm going to go there with a group, and I had that opportunity. And fortunately, I also had an NEH fellowship research grant that allowed me to take that on, and I was able to go and find some villages and some places where they still make paper in much the same way as it was when it was invented there 2,000 years ago. So that's the kind of writing approach I like to take, and it does give some structure and some flesh.
It's a research model, really. It's part of a research model.
And it's interdisciplinary. You know, if it's interviewing, I'll do interviews. If it's journalistic, I'll make it journalistic. Scholarly, whatever it takes to take these elements together and to make what I hope is a seamless approach that's accessible and inviting to a reader to come in and say, boy, this is a good story.
Yeah, it is. The book is a sweeping history of paper.
Or sweeping is the word.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of these words pop up, you know, that have to do with paper in one way or another. I was going to ask you, you know, if you could provide a kind of overview of the most crucial influences of paper, both in the past and presently, because it is something we take for granted. It's so ubiquitous in our lives. And I was going to use the word laundry list, but why not?
Well, let's start, you know, with the title, which is very straightforward. It's on paper, fine. But then my editor at Knopf, Victoria Wilson, she and I were both trying to come up with a subtitle for the book. And then she said, listen, let's just call it The Everything. And everything is a word. It's italicized. Yeah. So The Everything of its 2,000-year history. Now, I take pains to point out that this does not purport to really be everything, but it is an everything approach.
Yes.
That's to the point of your question there, that as far as I'm concerned, everything's in play. Hygiene, to go literally from one extreme to the other, from something that is disposable, shall we say, for hygienic purposes, all the way up to coin of the realm when you come to currency, something that people will move heaven and earth, even kill to possess, which is money. You know, what is currency? It's paper, and it's been around for hundreds of years. You know, Marco Polo came back in the 13th century, and lo and behold, it wasn't just paper that had been introduced there, but the great Khan was using it for currency.
Mm-hmm.
So this is kind of interesting. And paper, and I point out, it's one of the theses that I put forth, is the only manufactured product, the only one. If you can name me another, I'd love to know what it is. The only manufactured product that gets value, whether it be monetary or personal or emotional or historical, but which gets value strictly and totally by the intellectual construct, by what has been printed, written, drawn, inscribed on it. And, you know, you think that just recently at auction in New York, a Baisam book, right, the oldest known document printed in British North America, 1640, I guess it is, copy of this sold for $14.2 million. And if you look at it, it's not in the best of shape. It's a piece of paper, or it's a gathering of sheets of paper. Would it have value if it wasn't for what's printed on there? Or would a Honus Wagner baseball card, a corrugated cardboard, really be worth $2.7 million? It's preposterous when you think about it. It's really just a piece of paper, but it gets value. We ascribe value to it by what's put on it. I have a chapter in the book that I call Face Value, and I wrote that to test the premise of how some things are not worth the paper they're printed on. Again, you talk about going from one extreme to another. I go from a piece of Zimbabwean currency from 2006, you know, that I bought on eBay for a few pennies, and it's a $100 trillion note. And so what's that worth? Yeah. What were Reichsmarks worth during the Weimar Republic, or Continentals during the early years of the Revolution? You know, so currency, which had value, then had no value. You had a muse by Raphael. I guess the most money that's ever been spent for one piece of paper is close to $50 million per piece of paper. But what's on it? And as long as we put value on it, we talk about worthless currencies that I just mentioned. Well, they're worthless because people have lost confidence in them. It's still just a surrogate for the real thing. The American dollar has value because we ascribe value to it and people covet it. But it only has value so long as we ascribe value to it. It's like the difference between a first edition and a seventh edition. The seventh edition may be more scarce, but people value the first edition more. So what's more valuable? But I can't think of anything else where you'd find that other than paper.
Yeah.
And that's just in terms of, you know, the material that's on it. But when you get into concepts, and I think that was a great deal of the fun for me, the whole idea in that chapter where I deal with Leonardo da Vinci and Beethoven and Thomas Edison, and this, where I maintain that paper in these instances really becomes an instrument of the creative process. Would Leonardo da Vinci have been able to do the extraordinary things that he achieved really in his mind without paper and without pen? And this free-flowing, brainstorming, cascading way of creative expression that he had, and that Martin Kemp, the scholar I interview for that chapter, points out that it would have been impossible without paper. Or Beethoven, who really couldn't hear through much of his creative life and who carried paper with him everywhere and was constantly sketching out his musical thoughts. And Thomas Edison, who left 3,500 notebooks, which the National Park Service still has in New Jersey, which you could just go and see, here's a sketch for the light bulb, here's a sketch for the phonograph.
We have an exhibit up now here at Vassar on the architectural book, and we mainly focus on books, but...
Architecture, as you just pointed out.
Yes.
I'm just talking here, you know, about creative expression, but yes, architecture. Really, what did architects do before paper? You think about how it took generations, over 100 years, to build cathedrals. So, I mean, they did these things as they went along. These were very organic structures, this trial and error as they went up. But all of a sudden, you professionalized architecture. You developed instruments. You began to create to scale, and you had a plenitude of paper. You could make mistakes. The same thing with bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
Record keeping. We talk about record keeping as going electronic. I have a profile of the National Archivist in here. You know, he starts off by saying he's custodian of 80 billion pieces of paper.
Yes.
And we only preserve 5% of what's generated in a given year of the paperwork. And the government printing office continues to be the largest printing operation in the world.
Yeah.
Well, certainly much of the world. I don't know what goes on in China.
Yeah. With paper having been invented by the Chinese, that kind of overwhelming bureaucracy seems to have come right along with the invention of paper almost immediately, doesn't it?
Well, I think you can say the modern bureaucracy really is made possible by paper, and you mentioned China, but also one of the most really interesting, fascinating, beyond interesting, fascinating things for me to study was the migration of paper. You know, we talk about the Internet, and I use the word how it's galloped from country to country in a matter of years, a few years, 15, 20 years, however long we've had the Internet. And what I love about paper is it wasn't something that was inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it isn't just something that would have happened. It's an idea, and it really took perception. It really took some very bright person to figure out how to take cellulose fiber, and you can make paper from any kind of vegetative source, but it has to have cellulose in it for the hydrogen bonding, and you pound it into a pulp, and you add water, and you have to pass it through a sieve. So there's a process there that really had to be figured out, and the Chinese did that first. And it's just about exactly 2,000 years ago that they did this. But then what was really fascinating for me was the migration of this process.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like an 1,800-year process. And the Chinese kept it as a proprietary craft for at least 500 years or so. And then it moved in one direction through Korea towards Japan. And then it moved in the other direction along the old Silk Road. And it went into Central Asia and Europe and then the Middle East. And from the Middle East, the Arabs were the essential paper makers for a period of about 500 years. And it just parallels the great flowering of that culture in the Middle East, where Baghdad became the capital of the Islamic world. And when bureaucracy begins to be introduced also by the Ottomans, and how paper was so essential to the development of the modern bureaucracy. This stuff isn't just random. I think they're all connected, and you see paper every step of the way, in my view, as this player, not at the center of the stage, but just kind of off there, the wings playing an essential role. And that's kind of what I tried to develop and to write about in 18 different chapters, you know, and everyone a little bit different.
You mentioned that paper becomes a staple of the Islamic world for 500 years before it enters the medieval West, and most people have heard of the Alexandrian Library, you know, which was based on papyrus scrolls, but few people in the West have heard of the Bayt al-Hikmah, the House of Wisdom, the great Baghdad library of the 9th and 10th centuries, based on paper technology, which did play a huge part in the preservation and transmission of science and...
Absolutely essential. And you're right. And when you see these histories, and I don't know why that is, but I know Dart Hunter, the great historian of paper, even in his monumental book, The History and Technique of an Ancient Craft, he probably gives you 3 or 4 paragraphs on Islamic papermaking and in that part of the world. But I don't know whether it's just because we paid that much attention to history in that part of the world, but or what. I don't know the answer to that. But you're right. It just hasn't gotten the kind of attention here as it deserves. And you talk about these repositories, and they were paper, and the paper hadn't even been invented whenever you're talking about the Alexandrian Library, certainly not in the West. And what I think it's important to point out, because I always get this question, you say paper is 2,000 years old, the Chinese invented it, didn't it emerge directly from papyrus? And that's a normal thing, a natural thing to think and to ask, because they share the name.
Yes.
Well, we call this material paper in the West, and that does derive from papyrus. But the only thing they have in common are two things, is that it's flexible, and it's got a vegetative source, but that's it. Papyrus was Egyptian, but papyrus had to be made. It could only be made from that one marsh reed, which grew plentifully, abundantly along the Nile and in parts of Sicily and other parts of North Africa. And it had to be freshly harvested, and it was not a pulp. It was these fillets, like these thin strips of it's a triangular-shaped reed, sometimes it grew 20 feet in height. It was used for a number of things. They made cordage out of it, rope. The baby Moses, you know, was set adrift, according to the Old Testament, in a basket made of papyrus. And it was in a thicket of papyrus where he came to rest. So I mean, you see papyrus throughout the history there. And the age of papyrus is 3,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
It was the gold standard. But paper, on the other hand, you can make paper from any sort of vegetation. It has to be pounded into a pulp. It has to be immersed in water. And it has to be passed through a screen. So the two are decidedly different. And they are not related technologies. You know, one developed in one part of the world and the other developed in another part of the world.
Now, the interesting thing here is that paper tends to be kind of invisible in most people's stories of transmission of culture, doesn't it? I mean, printing, of course, takes up a lot of interest.
That's unfortunate. Yeah. You know, when Sir Francis Bacon talks about the great inventions that changed the world, the magnetic compass and gunpowder and printing, which were all Chinese inventions, right? And he fails to mention paper.
Yes.
He writes about paper in another context. The assumption had been for many centuries that paper and printing were allied developments, which they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I maintain that you're never going to have printing unless you have paper first. And that's really kind of how the way it worked, too, you know, that you talk about, you know, the Chinese were the first to, they invented printing, you know, 500 or 600 years. The Diamond Sutra, which survives, and it's in the British Library, I mean, the date on that is 868. Gutenberg's Bible doesn't come along till the 1450s. Of course, the Gutenberg was from metal type, and this is the Chinese printing was from wood blocks. But it's still, you know, more than 500 years ahead of the West. But in both instances, you had to have the paper first.
Yes.
In Germany, where Gutenberg develops the printing press from movable type, that's in the 1450s. But the first paper mill north of the Alps is also in Germany, just 1390, 50 or 60 years prior to that. Would Gutenberg, would he have invented the printing press if he didn't have paper?
Yeah, Gutenberg did experiment with parchment, didn't he?
He did. Of the 48 or so surviving Bibles, which we today call the Gutenberg Bible for him, but it was the 42-line Bible, of those, a good 15 or 20 of them are on parchment. So he did some luxury copies on parchment. But it's been estimated you needed the skins of 250 or 260 sheep just to make one of those Bibles on parchment. So obviously it was prohibitively expensive and impossible. But there was, simultaneous to this, there was this availability of this new miracle product, which was plentiful and it was cheap, useful for the task, and that was paper.
The interesting thing about paper as a type of technology is that it's produced in multiples right from the beginning, isn't it? And it has to be, along maybe with mud bricks, one of the first mass-manufactured items. Even the hand processors are somewhat mechanical. You know, there are steps to them, and it requires equipment. And so, you know, I wonder if you could look at printing as something of an extension of the same kind of technology.
I don't know if you can actually say that they are allied advancements. I mean, they're different technologies, but one does follow the other. You're not going to find Gutenberg tinkering with a wine press and whatever it was that he gave him the idea for creating and punching the matrices for movable type if he doesn't have a readily available source of a printing surface, which is paper. So really, one does, I think, prefigure the other.
Yeah. Doesn't paper making involve a press also often, or did it?
To squeeze out water, because it is a water-based process. And really, what is paper? But it's a film, really, if you think about it. And it's because of this miracle of hydrogen bonding, which wasn't really fully articulated until the 20th century. But it is what makes paper such a miraculous process, is it's this ability. And you find it, I'm not going to say uniquely, but really distinctively, because in cellulose, but they're called these hydroxyl bonds, where you have hydrogen and oxygen atoms contained in these same units, and they attach to each other. They're like magnets. And so when you pulverize cellulose into fibers, and you put them in a great deal of water, and then you pass it through a screen, and these fibers are left on top of the screen as the water drains out from below. And this process hasn't changed at all. It's become more mechanized. You've got these automated machines, but the process is the same. The water is removed, and what remains is a film, a mat of cellulosic fibers that form this sheet. And that hasn't changed. That's what happened in the beginning, and that's the way it continues to be. But in some processes, you take these layers or you put them on a felt sheet, and then you use a press to squeeze out excess water. So yeah, there's a press, but that is one of the differences between the Chinese and Japanese and Asian papermaking processes and European. They don't use felt in the Orient. They really didn't use presses at all. They would hang them out to dry in the sun, or they would brush them onto heated plates more recently, or just on walls to dry. And I observed that, took photographs of that when I went to China and also in Japan. I went to Japan the year after I went to China because I wanted to spend a day, and I did, with a living national treasure papermaker. There is such an individual in the world, and you can only see him in Japan. That's why you go to Japan. And so I did that.
Well, the Japanese certainly did embrace the Chinese invention there, didn't they? I mean, paper's an important part of the culture.
And made it their own.
Yes, you know? Yeah.
And it really goes beyond this material that you fabricate and you find so useful in just a multitude of ways. But then it becomes a part of your life and even a part of your spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And the Japanese did elevate it to that level and continue to do so. However, they are now down to, I guess it's maybe 300 or so individuals who continue to make paper by hand in Japan. You know, there were many, many thousands, really even up until recently, until World War II. Japanese paper, by the way, is considered the strongest and the best in the world, and there are a lot of reasons for that. They use a certain fiber called kozo, and it's for the bass, the fibrous substance that you find beneath the inner bark of this paper mulberry tree. And you don't have to harvest the whole tree, by the way, just the branches. But it has these very long, long fibers, which are just legendary for their strength and also their thinness. And it's just a remarkable paper. So during World War II, towards the end of the war, and as a response in an effort to bring the war to the American homeland, there were 10,000 paper balloons made. They were called balloon bombs, about 9,000 of which were launched. And the Japanese were the first to perceive what we call the jet stream. And it took a 3 or 4 or 5 days to cross the Pacific. And it was really highly censored here in America. But of the 9,000 that were launched, about 1,000 reached the shores of North America. They were random. And thankfully, most of the vast majority of them landed harmlessly. But in one instance, one fell in Oregon. A woman and 5 children out on an outing were killed by one of these devices. And it's the only instance during World War II where civilians died as a result from enemy action on the American continent. But there was all handmade paper that was used to make the skin of these balloon bombs.
Yeah.
We were talking about Japanese paper, so I'm sorry I went off.
No, it's an interesting story. I'm a pilot and interested in the history of flight, and of course, paper plays a big part in that, from the first balloons.
Well, the first human flight. Mm-hmm. I also have a pilot's license, but I'm fascinated by the history of aviation and the Montgolfier brothers, who were papermakers.
Yes.
You know, they were one of the great papermaking mills in Europe, and still in business as the Montgolfier firm. And the Montgolfier brothers were just really fascinated by this whole idea of balloons, which you could put hot air. What they found is that this paper from their mill, several layers of it, could generate enough lift to carry humans aloft. And so the very first example of human flight is in a hot air balloon made of paper. So there it is. You don't think of paper in that context usually, but again, it's going back to where is paper in the story, on the wings of the stage, but it's there. There is a very interesting supporting actor.
And you mentioned the spinning wheel has an important role in the history of paper.
Well, that's right, especially in Europe. And historians of technology say you have intended consequences of a certain development, and then there are unintended consequences. Well, consequences that you can expect. So when the spinning wheel comes into Europe, well, you can expect that there's going to be a glut now of cotton products. Mm-hmm. But what you maybe didn't anticipate is that you're also going to have a lot of rags. And where rags were then and continue to be the best source for making paper, why is that? You can make paper, as I said, from any vegetative source, but cotton is ideal because cotton is pure cellulose, which in turn makes the best paper. And then, of course, all of the great paper up until the 19th century, when they were finally able to figure out how to produce wood pulp from trees, much to the wool of forests around the world, you know, and actually made for a very inferior grade of paper. Rag paper continues to be the best paper, but, you know, the spinning wheel, I don't think anyone foresaw its use in creating rags, which in turn became the raw material for paper, but that's what happened.
You know, we think of paper as a not very permanent medium, say, as opposed to parchment.
All I can tell you is I've handled what we call the Gutenberg Bible. It's one of the great moments of my life. I describe it in my first book, A Gentle Madness, where I went to the library of William Scheide in Princeton, New Jersey, and he took out of this safe this big clamshell box, and he opened it. Then he invited me to go ahead and handle his copy, the only privately owned copy of the Gutenberg Bible, the first book printed in the West with movable type, and I darn near fainted on the spot, you know. But what I was touching, what he was allowing me to handle, was paper, you know, that's more than half a millennium old. And you look at it today, and it's just as gorgeous today as I'm sure it was when it was printed more than 500 years ago. So to say that paper was ephemeral, really good paper before we got into wood pulp of the 19th century, and we had all these acids and this lignin, which is another compound that you find in wood-based pulp, and so you get the phrase pulp fiction and yellow things that were brittle. But paper made with rag is wonderful stuff. It lasts. It's not all that perishable. And for me, when we talk about where is the printed book going, where is the traditional codex, the paper document going, is it going to be entirely replaced by things that are born digital? I just don't know how secure digital material is. You know, I mean, I'm not a Luddite here, you know. I mean, I use my computers and everything else with great enthusiasm, as everyone else does. But, you know, I just have a cautionary tale. And when I did go and I interviewed the National Archivist, David Ferriero, in Washington, D.C., who was really brought in, and he's the first career librarian to be the National Archivist, and he was very successful at the New York Public Library and at Duke and at MIT. And they wanted him to come in and try and really come up with a process to really ensure the longevity of these digital materials, because they are so transitory. I mean, I think back to my first computers that had 5.5-inch disks on different operating systems. You know, I'd love to go look at my first book that I wrote on this computer, but I'm not so sure I've got the software to access it. You know, can you really be sure the material that is born digital is going to survive 50 years, 100 years, 200 years? The first time in the history, in the whole long 5,000-year history of writing and various recording surfaces that we've used, and paper is just one out of many, but this is the first time where you have to have an interface, a mechanical interface. You need a power source. You know, you really need a machine and software to be able to read something. You need something more than just the ability to read. And I'm concerned about that. You know, you think about magnetic tapes that are no longer readable. You know, that's with quotes around it. You think of Viking space probe materials that are totally deteriorated, punch cards that nobody can read. All of these different softwares that were accessible once that may not be accessible 10 years from now. Who's at the switch? Who's controlling this? Who's going to make sure that all this stuff makes the migration, makes the transfer from one generation to the next? And when you talk to the National Archivist, David Ferriero, he still says, when we have something, even if it's born digital, if it is of such significance that we want an archival copy, they still make a paper copy of it. That's one you can be sure that's going to stick around for a while. So to go to your question about paper and parchment, you know, I say paper lasts, and it has lasted. And just go look at the earliest printed books. They're over 500 years old, and they're doing fine.
Yes, and you make an interesting observation in the book that paper was more valuable to the Ottomans for official documents because the writing on it is less erasable, because paper is much more permeable than parchment.
We think about paper as being erasable. Well, you know, erasers are just a very recent invention. The beauty of paper is it was really very useful when you were creating identification, because I have a whole chapter on identification. We are so often who and what our papers say we are. When you're asked to show your papers, you're being asked to identify yourself. One of the attractions of paper to the Ottomans was the fact, and not just identification papers, but deeds and documents, is that they couldn't be forged. Once you wrote in ink on these sheets of paper, they couldn't be changed without it being obvious. Parchment, you know, we talk about palimpsest. You know what a palimpsest is? It's writing that's beneath the writing. Largely on parchment, because it's animal skin. You can either brush it off or use chemicals to take it off and to use it again. And palimpsest is when you have layers of writings that have accrued over the centuries. You know, sometimes you have writings that are 3 or 4 and 5 layers deep, but you can't do that with paper. So paper really was a device against forgery and counterfeiting. And that really, as you say, as I point out in the book, you know, started to develop during the Ottoman period.
It is still the legal guarantor, isn't it, for contracts, diplomas, licenses, proof of identity, money.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, well, money, but there are still certain documents that you have to have a paper deed, am I right?
Yeah, oh yeah, everything.
You still transfer a title to a piece of property, it has to be notarized and signed and recorded in a registry of deeds. I mean, there are certain things that where the papers remain the essential document. That may change, I'm not going to say it won't, and I'm sure it's changing all the time. Now most people file their taxes electronically.
One thing I noticed across your book in your discussions about paper and its transmission is that when people start producing paper, it's accompanied by an explosion of information, and then bureaucracies come into play, but it's also accompanied by then shortages of resources needed for paper, like rags or whatever is being used. And that seems to be part of the story of paper, doesn't it, that it seems to cause...
Well, I have a chapter there that I call Rags to Riches.
Yes.
And we take it very literally, and that was really the chapter where I really wanted to look at the development, the introduction of papermaking in North America, which begins with the Rittenhouses. And it's very interesting. North America is really unique in that respect, because every other place where you had printing naturally followed the introduction of papermaking, but not here. Printing came to America before papermaking. The Baisam book and all of these other publications were printed on paper that was imported from Europe. And so you really don't get the first paper mill in the New World until 1690 outside of Philadelphia and the Rittenhouses, and then it kind of develops. And then that was controlled, and that was one way to control the colonies, really, when the British control the importation of paper. Once you started to have a domestic source of paper supply, then you got a little bit of independence. And I really do point out how the Stamp Act, for instance, 1764, is it 1765, really was all about how much we had come to rely on paper and the colonies, how much paper was so essential to daily life, because what the Stamp Act was, levying duties on at least 50 different uses of paper.
Paper, yes.
And charging fees to record a deed, to get a marriage license, to file a death certificate, to probate someone's estate, to practice law, to get a diploma. A duty was going to have to be paid on stamped paper made in England, stamped and embossed there, and it was this. And also all of the newspapers, and this was really considered the fatal flaw of the Stamp Act, is that had they just stuck with the official bureaucracy, the Stamp Act probably would have gone through, because everybody understood that there had to be some form of taxation in the aftermath of the French and Indian War. That's why it was passed, more than pay for the garrisons of British troops, which were going to have to come here and police these new territories that they had acquired. That language is very clear in the Stamp Act, but when they also decreed that there were going to be levies on the newspapers, you know, you really don't want to tick off the owners of newspapers, the people who own the bottles of ink. And that really began the Schlesinger Sr., you know, wrote that book, The Prelude to Revolution, begins really with the Stamp Act, the newspaper war against Great Britain. Well, these are all paper stories, aren't they? But, you know, again, still it was all made by rags. And so when you have this progression, finally what people everywhere were looking for were new sources of fiber to make paper. So long as you relied on rags, so as long as you relied on the detritus of a manufactured product, you were limited. So there were embargoes put on the exportation of rags. Companies went out of business. And up until they were able to figure out how to tap these forests, this seemingly inexhaustible supply of fiber, once that happened, well, then paper became a powerhouse industry, and particularly here in North America. And that's how I get that idea of the rags to riches, and how what was kind of a cottage industry then became a powerhouse industry, and then really how everything was possible with paper. For hygienic purposes, how it really became a very inexpensive commodity. And, you know, then there were certainly ramifications with the environment, and I'm not dismissing those in any way. That's been covered by other writers. I'm writing more about the paper and the consequences of it.
Just as an aside, when you're talking about the Stamp Act and the War of Independence, Benjamin Franklin, people know that he was a printer, but most people wouldn't know that he was a paper dealer. He was right in the middle of this, wasn't he?
He was so clever. In his own autobiography, he acknowledges owning, or at least owning, shares in no fewer than 18 different paper mills, because paper largely was imported, and you really were able to control your destiny if you could control your access to paper. So the Rittenhouse Mill, for instance, that I mentioned earlier, that was controlled by a fellow by the name of William Bradford, who Franklin wanted to work for, and then he went into competition with him. And what Bradford had done is he had cornered the supply of paper. He underwrote the formation of that Rittenhouse Mill so he could assure himself an adequate supply of paper. Well, Franklin, once he established himself in Philadelphia, he did the same thing. He underwrote the formation not only of paper mills and the making of paper, but he cornered the market on rags. So he actually trumped it. And he even mentions it in his autobiography, how his wife helped him buying the rags, making sure the rags got to the paper makers. He was a very, as we know, astute and savvy and brilliant guy in so many different areas. But yeah, to answer your question, in fact, it's people who have written about this say there's no reason to doubt the assertion that Franklin was probably the leading paper rag merchant in the colonies, you know, in the years leading up to the Revolution. He cornered the market on it, certainly down in that part of the country.
Yeah. You mentioned the devastating effect of papermaking on the world's forest once it was discovered that paper could be made out of wood pulp. And so apart from environmentally horrific practices such as strip mining, I can't think of any industry that has been as devastating to the surface of the earth and the earth's forest as has been, you know, the clear cutting associated with papermaking. And that's not counting the pollution of rivers and streams that paper mills have been notorious for. And we used to think of this devastation as the price we had to pay for newspapers. But actually, it's not newspapers, is it? It's bathroom and facial tissue that are responsible. So the question is, are paper companies becoming any more environmentally responsible?
Newsprint in particular today. Of course, newspapers are declining, so the demand for newsprint is certainly declined. But most of your newsprint is recycled anyway today. And so where so many of the forests were decimated to make newsprint, you don't find that so much. But in a strange turn of events, the tissue that we use for our hygienic purposes, toilet paper or Kleenex or whatever, the softer the paper that you want, and softness seems to become something that people really covet, requires generally the use of virgin fiber. So what a lot of these Greenpeace and conservation-minded organizations have done quite successfully, by the way, in particular, with respect to Kimberly-Clark, which is to try and to develop sources of wood that are environmentally conscious. But I have to say, that's not a major focus of my book, but I'm alert to it, and I agree with you. It is the black hole of the paper story, not just obviously the plundering of the forest, but the polluting of the waterways.
You do ask yourself, does there have to be a necessary trade-off between hygiene and destruction of the environment? And hopefully the answer is no.
No, and I profile a paper maker, Mark Cal in New Jersey, and they're not by any means alone, but they pioneered the whole concept of 100% recycled toilet paper. They make a million rolls a day, and it's not just 10% or 20%. I mean, you can call yourself recycled fiber if you only use 10 or 15 or 20%. I don't know what the exact percentage is, but they use 100%, and all their paper comes from the office buildings of Manhattan. You know, whenever you see those blue recycling bins, or curbside paper waste or magazines, that goes out to their plant in New Jersey. And so, I mean, there are alternatives, and they have come up with processes for giving you a softer product.
Interestingly, paper, it's almost from the beginning been made from recyclable materials, and it's recyclable itself.
Paper is the first manufactured product that I can think of that relied from the very beginning on recycled material. Yeah. The very first Chinese formula is articulated by Kai Lun in 105 AD, the first one to articulate it, and the formula included discarded fish nets, you know, rags, hemp from cordage. So it was really the detritus of other manufactured products that went into the mix along with other natural fibers. And as long as it's cellulose, you can make paper out of it. And so it really is a recyclable material.
Yes. We were talking to historian Leah Price a while back about the use of paper and books, but paper in particular in Victorian England. And her book is mostly about the way paper was itself recycled to do other things. It's repurposed. Before the price drops dramatically in the middle of the 19th century, newspapers used in cooking, for instance, it's almost never just discarded. It's used until there's almost nothing left of it.
Yeah, and that's one of the problems that you find if paper is constantly
being reused.
Yeah, the fibers keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And so if you're looking for softness, you know, well, then you have to introduce some virgin fiber. Now, can you do this with sawdust or with bark or with a lot of the byproducts from the forest industry? So they're doing a lot of that, too, as well. Material that's not necessarily trees that are harvested strictly to make these papers, but maybe it's the byproducts that come out of that industry. So you find a lot of that happening. And you find a lot of trees that are fast-growing, eucalyptus trees that are kind of you're going to find a lot more of them being used because they grow quickly.
Mm-hmm. Are we, as some people seem to believe, or at least you hear, headed toward a paperless society?
Well, that's a softball for me.
Yeah.
I cite a figure put out by an association of British paper historians a couple of years ago, and they cite a figure of there being something on the order of 20,000 identifiable commercial uses today of paper, you know, 20,000. So if you say, and there's no question, undeniable, newspapers are dying, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're being replaced. I'm a great advocate of the printed book. I prefer the printed book, but okay, who knows how long it will be before there will be more electronic books. So I can't say. Electronic record keeping, fine. But you're just talking about a very small fraction of the use of paper in the world to say that we are about to become a paperless society. I did an op-ed piece for the LA Times a couple months ago, and that was really the whole thrust of the piece, the myth of the paperless society. And I do give you an example of a company in Pennsylvania in my book, the Glatfelter Company, who they have seen their fortunes go from a modest $500 or $600 million a year back in 1998, 2000, to figures that are now approaching $2 billion a year. And now that sounds like a lot of money, and it certainly is to most of us. But in the paper world, you know, that's compared to the $27 billion a year of international paper, it's small potatoes. But how have they nevertheless gone to tripling their business over the last 10 or 12 years? By diversifying, by saying, well, we're not just going to make paper for the publishing industry. And in fact, my book is, I'm sure, printed on Glatfelter paper because they just bought all of the paper for the publishing industry from of quality book publishing paper. But they make, by their estimate, paper for 1,000 different products.
Yeah.
They make 75 to 80% of the paper in the world for tea bags. They make 75 or so percent of all the paper for Hallmark greeting cards, most of the paper for postage stamps, Reese's peanut butter cups, wrappers. So they've gone out and they've identified niches where they can make paper, where there continues to be a demand and where it's useful. And in the process, they've made themselves a very successful business. And I will point out that the Crane Paper Company, seven generations, since the 1870s, they've been the exclusive manufacturer of paper for United States currency. I think they make 50 or 60% of the paper for currency in the world, not just for the United States, but for other countries. And the 200 years of their existence, they've never used a single tree to make paper. American currency is 75% cotton and 25% flax. It's a tree-free operation. When you pull a piece of American currency, it's really, it's rag paper.
Yeah, the assumption is somehow computing is going to make paper obsolete, but I find it interesting that the basic stratum of the computer interface on a screen, you know, whether it's a web page or a word processing page or a page in Microsoft Illustrator, say, whatever, is an emulated white sheet of paper. So
isn't that funny?
When I look at the sweep of your whole book, looking at the role that paper's played and still plays in human culture over time, you know, it has such a beautiful aspect, especially the handmade stuff with beautiful uses. You know, we still use it to send greeting cards. Our intellectual culture is based on it. Money is based on it. But on the other hand, it has this dark side. Gun cartridges, balloon bombs, money again, if you think of money as a source of greed.
Cigarettes. More people have died. This is not me saying this. This is the author of a Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Ashes to Ashes. He cites figures that can tell you that more people died from cigarettes in the 20th century that died in all the wars combined. And cigarettes are made possible by paper, which I show in the Fiery Consequences chapter, emerged directly out of cartridge paper for bullets, which totally transformed the whole nature of armed conflict.
Yeah, so with these contradictions, I wonder if there's an allegory here or a moral or a kind of wisdom or attitude we can't take away from contemplating paper. You know, when I'm thinking of the Japanese concept of washi and origami.
Well, if I may, because I certainly thought long and hard about this over the years that I was writing the book. And what I use for my coda, and, you know, I think when people read the book and they get to the final chapter and into the epilogue and they say, what in the world is he doing writing about 9/11 in here? You know, how does the World Trade Center and the attack on 9/11, what's that got to do with paper? But when you think of all that paper, all of my books have either started with an image or concluded with an image, but for me, that image of all that paper just geysering out of those buildings, and they were the only artifacts of any consequence to survive that day. Mm-hmm. The new 9/11 museum in New York is going to rely so overwhelmingly on paper artifacts, and you would think that in the first year of the third millennium, 2001, you know, that... And these two iconic buildings, certainly iconic with respect to American capitalism and Wall Street, the symbol of our whole notion of our nation crumbling to the ground and all this paper flowing out. Was it all just mundane stuff, cleaning stock market things, just the minutiae of daily business? Was there anything of significance and of historical significance that was recovered? And, you know, and I tell two stories about one little piece of common bond paper that was recovered, that was picked up by the South Tower by a woman, you know, fleeing the scene. And it's a totally documented story. She picks it up and she reads it, and it says 84th floor, northwest side, 12 people trapped. And she looks up and she runs away and she turns this piece of paper over to a guard outside the Federal Reserve Bank. And then at that moment, the building crumbles to the ground and everyone who died perishes. And no name, there's no name on that piece of paper, just 84th floor. And so does that little piece of paper speak for all of the 3,000 victims that day? And I believe it does. But then beyond that, you talk about a piece of paper being able to carry its message forward and to serve as an example. Here's one person not just trying to save himself, but 11 other people. I say him because how do we know it's him? Because if you look at that piece of paper, I've got a photograph of it in the book. There's a little smudge there on the margin, and that smudge is blood. And just as I was completing this book, they were able to make a DNA match. And we found out, you know, we were able to learn who wrote that letter, who wrote that plea for help, and who gave that message, who passed on that message, not only to us and to his family, but to people who say, what is the power that one single piece of common bond paper can carry and can pass on? And for me, that is kind of a coda.
Yeah.
And in fact, is the epilogue to my book. And this is not beautiful handmade paper. It's not anything special. There were millions upon millions of pieces of paper that came out of those buildings that day. But here's one bearing a message that kept its true secret for more than 10 years until it was finally, you talk about secret ink, it was able to reveal its true identity. And by doing so, to carry on its message. And it will be a centerpiece exhibit in the new 9/11 museum. It opens very shortly. Anyway, that I offer is kind of an epilogue, and is, in fact, the epilogue to the book.
Yeah, it's a medium of transcendence and a nice way to end and something to think about as we encounter paper every day in so many different ways. So I'd like to thank you, Nick, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe to talk about your book, On Paper, The Everything of Its 2,000-Year History, published by Knopf.
Thanks. It's been a pretty stimulating conversation.
Yeah, it has, and thank you for that.